2 years ago, thieves stole 600 barrels of maple syrup, worth millions of dollars, from the Global Strategic Maple Syrup Reserve in Quebec. While the odd-sounding news of a maple syrup cartel made headlines, the story also served to highlight an overlooked industry with high profits and a deep cultural history. In this hour of midday, all about maple sugar, Douglas Wynot, a writer based in New England, offers us an up-close look at a family operation in New Hampshire. And we'll hear about maple syrup production in Maryland from Leo Shinhold. He's the owner of the S&S Maple Camp in Corriganville, Allegheny County. From Canada to New England and Western Maryland, it's maple sugar time on midday. First, the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodrigues here. Thanks for joining us for the second part of our show today. It's around this time of year when the temperature falls below freezing overnight and above freezing during the day, when it rises above freezing during the day, that the sap of the maple tree runs fast and maple syrup production is at its peak. So to celebrate sugar season, we're taking a look at the industry of maple syrup production today, the hardworking farmers rooted in a family tradition, the speculators looking to make a fast buck, and even some maple syrup intrigue, such as the thieves who 2 years ago managed to pull off a multi-million dollar maple syrup heist that revealed to the world the existence of a maple syrup cartel. We'll be joined during the show today by Leo Shinhold, a Western Maryland farmer whose S&S Maple Camp in Corriganville, that's out in Allegheny County in the western part of the state, is the largest such camp in Maryland. We'll also hear from Jesse Janetta, a naturalist at the Oregon Ridge Nature Center who does maple sugaring demonstrations there. She'll be joining us a little bit later in the hour today. But up front, we speak with Douglas Wynot, who is really occasions this conversation today because of his book. He's a New England-based writer and a fine writer who spent the sugar season of 2012 documenting the life of a family in the maple syrup industry up in New Hampshire. Their work takes them into knee-deep snow to drill holes, install tubing, and tap several thousand maple trees. In the sugar season, a year in the life of maple syrup and one family's quest for the sweetest harvest. That's the title of Doug's book. Doug introduces us to Bruce Bascom, president of one of the largest producers and wholesalers of maple syrup in the country. His family's been producing the syrup since 1853. The sugar season, by our guest Doug Wynot, is filled with a wide variety of interesting characters who make up the maple syrup industry, and it goes into detail into the technological innovations that turned the once dwindling localized industry into a profitable enterprise, where a barrel of syrup now costs more than a barrel of crude oil. Also, climate change is having an effect on the industry. We'll talk about that today. And let's get to Doug Wynot. Douglas, thank you very much for joining us on the show.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
What brought you to this particular project?
Well, there were a few things. The first was that in back in the late 90s, my wife and I moved to New Hampshire from Western Massachusetts so that she could have a second career as an elementary school teacher. And she ended up getting a position at in Charlestown, New Hampshire, on the Connecticut River, southwestern New Hampshire. And one of the things that she did in her third grade class each year was to take the kids out to a sugar house and to watch maple syrup being made. It was part of their education in the local economic culture. So she got to know about this place. It was called Putnam's Sugar House, and I went there with her. And it became a regular thing for us to visit this sugar house and then to visit others. So that was the first thing. We became involved in the local maple syrup culture in our part of New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. The other thing was that as a writer, I had been thinking for a while about what it might be like to write about trees through the perspective of a forester, the eyes of a forester. I wanted to know what a forester might see when he looked at trees that I wasn't seeing. And the third thing was that in 2009, there was the discovery of an infestation of an invasive species of insect called the Asian longhorn beetle in Worcester, Massachusetts. And that resulted in a quarantine of that area and the cutting of 20,000 trees, because this insect is very damaging to leafy trees. And it had attacked a lot of maple trees. So after I heard that 20,000 trees had been cut down because of this insect, I wondered what it might be like if this insect got up into New Hampshire and Vermont, into the maple trees, and how it might affect the maple syrup industry, and also the fall foliage season, and just the, you know, the lay of the land. So I called Bruce Bascom. I had heard that he was the a very large producer of maple syrup. I didn't know then that he was the biggest producer in New Hampshire. Putnam's Maple Farm, where I went, was, I thought, enormous. They made 2,000 gallons a year. But Bascom's, back when I was when I heard about him, was making 10,000 gallons per year. Mm. So I called Bruce Bascom, and I asked him about this insect and what he thought. And he talked to me for a while on the phone. And we talked about the Asian longhorn beetle, but he soon got on to other matters. He started talking about other parts of the industry, his own experience in it, the international story. I became interested. I asked if I could visit him at his store. He has quite a big complex in Acworth, New Hampshire. So I went to his store, and I spent 3 hours talking with him on that day in January 2010. And near the end of our conversation, he said that his crew was about to go out into the woods and start tapping trees. So I said to him, "Can I come along? Can I watch?" And he said, "Sure, just show up at 7:30 in the morning and see what happens." So that was late January 2010. It was a rainy day in January, in the mid-30s. There was a lot of snow on the ground. I tromped along behind these workers. They were actually putting up tubing on that day, plastic tubing, which they used to collect sap, and talked to them and got to know them a little bit that day.
You know, at the end of that, Doug, I was just going to say, it's interesting that you were there. You were a New Englander. You were living there. Yeah. And as you say, you were familiar with the local culture and then connected to Bruce Bascom. But, you know, a lot of people listening to this might wonder, how much maple syrup is actually produced in this country the old-fashioned way? You know, because we look at, you go to the supermarket, you look at what's for sale, those golden bottles, Aunt Jemima, right, and the other ones, Mrs. Butterworth and whatever. You know, I guess we know that it's, what, corn syrup or some other thing just labeled as syrup. It's not, it doesn't say maple on it. It has a maple flavor. Lots of people mm-hmm. like that. I think you point out in the book that some waitresses told you in Boston that they get better tips when they serve the sort of imitation stuff rather than the real thing. So, I mean, on some level, it must, maybe it doesn't surprise you because you live there in New Hampshire, but it might surprise some people that to see that the industry of this scale is still going on and harvesting pretty much the old-fashioned way.
Well, yeah, that takes us over into the area of maple syrup and the taste of maple syrup mm-hmm. and what that means. And the importance of maple syrup to the culture. And it's very important in the local culture. This product is pure maple syrup. As far as the, and that has a value compared to the imitation syrup, which is made out of corn syrup and an artificial flavoring. As far as the crop in the United States, that's 20 to 30 million pounds per year, about 2 to 3 million gallons of pure maple syrup, but 90% of the crop, the commercial crop that you'll find in the supermarkets, is made by about 10% of the people, and those producers are not using what we think, you know, usually think of when it comes to making maple syrup, which is buckets hanging on spouts on trees, and then the buckets are poured into a big tank, and maybe horses are pulling those buckets, or maybe a tractor. And then it's boiled and boiled and boiled until it's pure maple syrup. Now, some people still do that, and there are variations on that. But the commercial producers who are making maple syrup, they gather their syrup from those trees by using plastic tubing. Now, when I was at Bascom's, they had about 65,000 taps. That's a hole in a tree with a spout in it. They had about 65,000 taps and a total of about 1,750,000 feet of plastic tubing, which turned out to be 300 plus miles. Connected to the various trees.
That is a wow. Unless you've been up in New England and seen this done, you might be surprised, because people do have this picture of the buckets attached to spouts on maple trees.
Yeah.
And now you go, you see woods with all these colorful tubes. I was just in Vermont recently and saw those all over the place. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Well, the really amazing thing about that tubing is that vacuum pumps are attached to the tubing. The tubing is attached to vacuum pumps, and that sucks the sap out of the trees, and it goes into tanks, or it might go right into a sugar house. So the idea that 330 miles of plastic tubing is all under vacuum pressure and below the pressure of the atmosphere, drawing the sap out of the trees, is kind of the most amazing thing about it.
And the Bascom family, you mentioned Bruce Bascom, his farm up there, Bascom Farms, and this, I have it as Ackworth, New Hampshire. Is that right, Doug?
That's right, Ackworth.
Yeah. They produce retail and wholesale. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me just remind our listeners, we're speaking with Douglas Wynot. His book is The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest, and that family is the Bascom family in New Hampshire. I have a question for you about what's happening right now, this time of year. Of course, mm-hmm. I know it varies from year to year based on the weather, and we've had quite a cold spell here in the Mid-Atlantic, and I know up in the Northeast you have too. So we're in the early March, and the harvest has been underway this year in 2014. What do you know about the harvest this year?
It hasn't started yet.
Oh.
I heard your temperatures are, you're in the 20s down there.
Oh, yeah.
In Maryland,
yeah.
Correct? Yeah, up here it's the same, except it was three degrees this morning, and it was in the teens when I left my house. And as a result, the sap flow hasn't started. It's usually well underway by now. So this is one of those years that makes me think of a Canadian winter, you have a prolonged cold and prolonged cold, and the trees stay frozen. And then all of a sudden, toward April, it gets warm really fast, and the season is very short, and the maple syrup crop is also short. You have a poor maple syrup crop. So we're kind of having that winter this year, and producers up here in the north are worried that this will continue, because the forecast is for below average temperatures in March all through the month. During the season, which I cover in the book, the 2012 season, at around March 8, the temperature shot up into the 60s, 70s, and 80s and stayed above freezing for 10 days. That was 240 hours of temperatures above freezing. Now, that means that the sap flow is going to be very unpredictable and possibly stop, because the sap flow depends on those nights, that time of the year called the freeze-thaw period, when you have nights that are below freezing and days above freezing. And that churning back and forth between freezing and thawing is what causes the sap to flow.
I was going to ask you, so what's the ideal? Ideal would be freezing overnight, and then what?
Mid-20s to mid-40s.
Mid-40s. That's the range that they're looking for.
Yeah, that's the ideal. Now, when you get up into the 50s and 60s, the quality of the sap starts to change, because bacteria and various small microorganisms play a role in the quality of the sap throughout the season. So it begins to degrade a bit. During 2012, when the temperature got up into the 80s, the sap, instead of coming out of the trees like a clear water that has some sweetness in it, with some producers who I talked to, they said it was like jelly coming out of the trees, and a couple of them said it was like cottage cheese.
Hmm.
They had to shut right down. And the flavor of the syrup that was made from that sap became what they call buddy. It had a taste of the leaf in it. It was a little bit sour after that time.
Doug, I have a question for you. You talked about 65,000 taps on the Bascom farm. That's kind of amazing. That represents about how many trees, or terms of acreage?
Well, they put, well, as far as acreage goes, they have about 800 acres on their sugar bush. Bruce Bascom amassed a huge amount of land during the 1980s. He owns about 2,400 acres, which is a lot for New England. And so 65,000 taps might mean about 55,000 trees, 50,000 trees, because on the big ones that have been around for a long time, they put two and even three taps in a tree. But most of them have one tap. All right. They have 80,000 taps this year.
I have a question then before we go to our first break. It has to do with the stewardship of the trees. I've always wondered about this. How far does the maple farmer go in terms of taking sap from a particular tree before he endangers the tree?
Well, that gets into the skill of the work. Tapping a tree is a skillful operation. It's a skill in itself. And the person who knows what he or she is doing is very careful to place that small hole, it's 5/16 of an inch, in a different place each year, because the tree will heal that section by covering it up and creating a hardwood that doesn't have flow through it. So if you tap and put your holes all in one place, you begin to get a solid mass of this dead wood that expands within the tree, and eventually you can girdle it. But people who know what they're doing will tap in a different place each year and keep that tree healthy.
Okay, Doug, thank you very much. We're going to take our first break here. Douglas Wynot, author of The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest. When we get back, more with Douglas Wynot, and we'll also speak with Leo Shinholt, who's owner of the S&S Maple Camp in Corriganville, Maryland. That's out in Allegheny County. He's been in the maple production business for more than 45 years, and tell us about how it's going out there. A short break on Midday. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday on WYPR. Dan Rodericks here. We're discussing maple syrup, the maple syrup industry this hour, during talking about the season that's actually hasn't really started yet up in New England, according to our guest Douglas Wynot, author of The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest. This is a new book published by DeCapo Press. So, Doug, thank you again for joining us on the show.
Oh, you're welcome.
There must have been something about this that really wowed you, something you didn't know before about the maple sugar harvest, or just in general. What's the most impressive thing about it? You can talk about the Bascom operation specifically, but you know, what really surprised you as you looked into this as an author?
Well, it was the Bascom operation, first of all, because they were so big. And it was also the fact that they make 25,000 gallons a year, but I was told early on that that's only 2 or 3% of what they actually sell. So Bruce was buying maple syrup from everywhere, all over the Northeast and from Canada, and he had this huge network that stretched out. So I saw Bruce as kind of the center to a big, you know, a wheel with spokes in it, and he was willing to send me out and introduce me and let me talk to many people. So that was one thing. The other thing was the climate change issue, the weather issue. That first year in 2010, it was a warm season. It got not as warm as 2012, but it was warm. And so I started looking at climate change reports, and I discovered that some studies had been made that showed that the average temperature has risen by 2 degrees since 1970. And if we continue to increase emissions by the current rate, it may be 6 to 8 degrees by the end of this century. And if that's the case, according to these reports, these government reports, the climate of New Hampshire will be like the climate of North Carolina. And so that's alarming. And according to these reports also, they used maple syrup as an example, or as, you know, one of the industries that might be most affected by changing weather. And it said that if that happens by the end of this century, there might be just a severely diminished maple syrup industry that will just be viable in the northernmost areas of the country. So that drew me in as well. But really, it was the people involved that I was meeting through Bruce Bascom, and that I thought would be very interesting people to write about and to talk to and to describe this overall culture. And then another thing was the Canadian part of it.
I can't wait to Canada. Get to that. Yeah. we're going to talk about the Canadian maple syrup cartel in Quebec. Yeah. That's coming up in a few minutes. But when you talk about people, we're going to meet someone from Maryland now, Doug, who's involved in the maple harvesting here in our state. So I just want to take a few minutes to speak with Leo Shinholt, who's making some time for us today. Leo is the owner of S&S Maple Camp. That's in Western Maryland in Allegheny County, a climate that's not unlike what you find in New England. So, Leo, thank you very much for joining us on the show.
Well, hi, Dan. How are you doing today?
I'm good. And Doug Wynot is on with us. He wrote this book about the sugar season up in New Hampshire.
Yes, I've been listening to him. Very educational. 100% right.
Well, Leo Shinholt, tell us about your season this year, 2014. You heard what Doug said about the New England season. How does it look down here in Maryland?
Well, in Maryland, and I'm near the Pennsylvania border, quite a lot of sugar houses around here, and we have boiled syrup once. And some of the sugar camps haven't even tapped yet.
That's amazing. We had
7 degrees here this morning, and it's up to, when I come in, it was 22. And our trees are all frozen. We gathered one time. And we processed that. Monday a week ago was the only time that we boiled. And we're all just hoping for a break in the weather, but we don't want it to get all warm at one time. We want it to 25, 45 is the temperatures we like, and we're hoping.
Leo, I want to ask you about S&S Maple Camp, your family's camp there in Allegheny County. You started tapping trees in 1968, but those trees have been in your family. That land's been in your family a long time. Prior to that. So I wonder what made you and others in the family decide to start tapping trees in the 1960s?
Well, I was fascinated with it. In 1960, I guess I tapped my first trees, and I was probably 10 years old. And we did find some pictures of me and my grandfather in 1961 we tapped. And it was just a fascination that has always been, it's been a love. It's been a love that I've had for making maple syrup. And after I graduated from high school, I went in the Army and come back, and me and my grandmother and my girlfriend went to Vermont and bought an evaporator and a bunch of buckets, and it started off as a hobby, and now it has grown into a great farm business.
And, Leo, do you use the tubes that Douglas was describing that you can see up in New
England?
Oh, yes.
We use tubing. We have one grove that my nephew runs, and it's on vacuum. It works great. We still have one grove that's 4,000 tap that is on natural flow. And the buckets that we use are right here on the home farm. I just love seeing those buckets on the trees. Our trees are all scattered through fields and out here, and I just like it the old way yet.
Yep. Leo, we appreciate that. Can folks visit S&S Maple Syrup Camp?
Oh, sure. We have a lot of folks come in during production time and see our trees drop, because they set in fields here and they're easy to get to, and people really enjoy seeing this.
And it's Corriganville, Maryland. Probably lots of our listeners haven't heard of that, but that's Allegheny County. You're up north of Cumberland, right?
Yeah, I'm 6 miles north of Cumberland. Corriganville sets on one side of the creek, and I set on the other side, my farm does. We're blessed with a lot of sugar maple in this area.
Leo Shinholt, I got to ask you this one question. Is there a particular tree, one particular tree, that you have in your groves there on the farm that really produces for you when the conditions are right, when it's freezing at night, 40 degrees during the day, freezing at night, 40 degrees during the day, this tree really produces for you?
Dan, yes, I do. I have one great tree up here that all my life I can remember it would always drop really good. It's on buckets. It's a tree that's very, very healthy, and it's probably 4, 4.5 foot across in diameter. And we kept a record on it several years ago. And usually a tree on natural flow produced 15 gallons of sap, you're happy. This tree, I knew, always did that. And this one particular year, we put a paper and a pen in a bottle and laid it there at the tree and kept a record. And that year, that tree produced 63 gallons per tap hole.
Wow. Per hole?
Per tap hole, yeah.
Wow. Wow. And so I want to ask you this question. That's impressive. Because the question I asked Douglas Wynot a moment ago is, in the stewardship of the trees and taking care of those trees, do you just take as much sap as that tree will give you under those conditions and then you stop? Or do you have to, like, leave some sap behind? Sorry if that sounds like a dumb question.
Well, how that is, when we drill our hole, which is a 5/16 hole, and if you have ideal conditions with this freezing and thawing, that hole will last probably, for us, 3 weeks. And after that, they dry out. Oh. And what they do, they just form a film in where you'd cut in with your tapping bit, and they'll quit on their own.
So the tree tells you.
The tree tells us, yes.
Leo, this has been great speaking with you. So I got to make a visit out there to Corriganville, the other side of the creek, SNS Maple Camp in Allegheny County. And there are some other producers of maple syrup in Maryland, too. And I'm glad we were able to tell our listeners about this. A lot of folks around Balmer may not know that Maryland produces some maple syrup.
Oh, yes. We have a lot of camps and in the last 5 years, we have had a lot of new young camps come in with young folks running them, and that's great, great.
Leo, it was a pleasure getting you on the show today.
Well, thanks for having me, sir.
Yeah, and I guess you're still waiting now for the right conditions,
right? We're waiting,
right?
But this week looks like it's going to be a good one for us, so we're just waiting.
Well, good luck to you, Leo.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Leo Schinholt. I got to meet him, Doug.
You see what I mean about the people?
Yeah, he's out there in Allegheny County in Western Maryland. I'll just tell our folks again, SNS Maple Camp. And I know they have some demonstrations. You can go there and buy their products and might need to make a trip out there. So you heard what he said. He's in the same sort of holding pattern they are up in New England right now.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I wondered what was happening down in Pennsylvania and in Maryland. I didn't know that they were making syrup in that part of Maryland. I had heard they were in West Virginia and in Kentucky because I met a guy in Pennsylvania who was selling equipment to someone in Kentucky. But that's great to know. What a cool guy.
I enjoyed that conversation. Let's slip up north then and talk about Quebec, as you wanted to do before. And you heard me at the beginning of the show remind folks about this story that was out a few years ago about this big theft from a warehouse I forget how many millions of pounds of or millions of dollars worth of maple syrup taken from what seemed to be like a strategic maple syrup reserve. And a lot of folks thought that was funny. And I remember on the Daily Show, Jon Stewart and company did something with that. But this really opened people's eyes to just how much maple syrup the Canadians produce.
That was hilarious. Well, one of the ironies of this whole Canadian thing is that the Federation of Quebec Maple Syrup Producers, which is a organization of 7,400 producers up in Quebec, it's an agricultural union that is controlled by the province, and they have the union representing other dairy and wheat and other things, but they've been representing maple syrup producers for a while now, and all of the bulk syrup that is sold has to go through the Federation. They created a marketing order in 2002, and they also created a surplus that year in which they would set aside a certain amount of maple syrup in the event of a shortage. And in the event of a winter, say, that was like this one, when it was possible that they didn't produce a lot of syrup, And wouldn't be able to fulfill their orders and put maple syrup on the shelves in the supermarkets. They created this surplus. And in 2004, because they had already accumulated the amount of syrup of a full year's crop, the Quebec Federation established quotas. And they only allowed their producers to produce so much of a percentage of their sugar bush. And that created a big problem. There were plainclothes policemen at meetings, and there were death threats, and the president's sugar house was burned down. But they proved to be right, because in 2005, 6, 7, and 8, there were shortages because of these delayed sustained cold winters. And the surplus provided syrup for buyers throughout the region who were able to put syrup on the shelves in supermarkets. But anyway, they lost 25% of their shelf space. And to this day, I know a buyer. He's Bruce Bascom's buyer. He's still trying to put that fourth quart back on on the supermarket shelves. So after the 2011 season, which was a cold winter just right, the conditions were just right. It was an exceptionally high crop in the United States. The Quebec surplus became very, very high. They had to rent a third warehouse to store their surplus. And during late 2011, a group of people in Quebec got into one of this rented warehouse. They rented a space in the warehouse, and they brought in a tanker truck, and they began emptying barrels into the tanker truck, some each day or whatever it was. They began taking it out of there and taking it to other places. In July of 2012, an auditor discovered that a lot of syrup was missing. Now, this is in the middle of the summer.
Right.
So an investigation began, and they arrested a lot of people. I've heard that there were 23 people arrested at the end of 2012, but I've heard that the trials are about to start, and Bruce Bascom told me recently that as many as 30 people might go on trial. But what they did was they cleverly moved the syrup into the market during that time of year, before the new season begins, when syrup is a little short in some cases, and producers who have been holding back their syrup, maybe to cash in on a shortage, release it. So it's a time of year, this time of year, when a lot of syrup is moving into the market for various reasons. So this syrup flooded the market. And for people, the kind of people who I was talking to, you know, some of them like these big packers like Bruce Bascom and others who have to buy so much syrup. Bruce buys more than 12 million pounds per year. That was in 2012. It's more now. That's more than a million gallons of syrup. And so he is, you know, going to producers in New York and Vermont and Maine and also Quebec to find his syrup. And so he's one of these many people who need to get product to mm-hmm. put on the shelves. And mm-hmm. and so there were a lot of people who were ready to buy syrup that may have been selling at a little bit below the market price. And not being suspicious, because that happens that time of the year. So
I see. A question. It sounds like the theft was in part a protest.
Well, no.
No? They were doing this to make money, obviously, but I'm just thinking there was a bit of an anarchist involved in this, too.
Yeah. Right? Well, there's a group that is opposed to the control that the Federation of Quebec Syrup Producers exerts upon the market, because if everyone who buys syrup in quantity in Quebec on the bulk market has to do it through the Federation.
Right.
So there were a lot of people before 2002, when this marketing order came into place, who were called barrel rollers, and they bought syrup in large quantities, and they sold it to packers in the U.S. or wherever. Well, when the Federation came in, those people were put out of business. And when they established quotas on syrup producers in Quebec, well, a black market would, of course, develop. When I talked to the president of the Federation, I asked her, is there a black market? And she said, well, that's human nature.
Wow.
So
a black market for maple syrup.
Yeah, it's crazy. But, there were a lot of stories that came out about it after the theft was discovered, and that, you know, the John Stewart thing, and it was everywhere, because suddenly we realized that there was a global strategic reserve for maple syrup, which sounds crazy. We call it the surplus, to protect the markets. And, you know, it was reported that a barrel of maple syrup is worth more than a barrel of oil. So, you know, and Hollywood got onto it, and now they're going to produce a movie with Jason Segel. I think it's going to be a comedy.
You're kidding.
Yes, it's
true.
Great. It's true.
Well, I have two questions about this.
Sure.
One, how does all that affect the prices or the profit margins for people like Bruce Bascom and others in the United States? Because they're not involved in this federation, right?
No, they're not involved, but he has to buy syrup through the federation.
I got
Bruce
that.
Has a bu-
but generally speaking, does it help the price of maple syrup in the United States?
Well, yes, because the federation, the Quebec, controls... Quebec makes 70 to 80% of the world crop of maple syrup, so the Federation sets the price and effectively controls the world price. So the producers in Quebec are protected with this price. They don't get paid that full price because they have to support the surplus, and that is held until later. But the irony is that producers in the U.S. also benefit from that floor price, that world price, mm-hmm. that the Federation has established. And so the U.S. is now undergoing an expansion based on the stability that the Federation has created. When your last speaker talked about the young people getting into the business, I was thinking, well, they are probably benefiting from the Federation price because banks will now lend to maple syrup producers because the market is stable.
Doug, we're going to take another break here. Douglas Wynot, our guest in this hour of midday, author of The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Perfect Harvest. More with Doug when we get back. And we'll also be joined by Jessica Janetta, naturalist at the Oregon Ridge Nature Center, just north of Baltimore here. She does maple sugaring demonstrations there. And we'll hear about that when we get back. So a short break on midday. More about maple syrup. The Sugar Season is published by DeCapo Press. And welcome back to Midday. The Sugar Season is Douglas Wynot's latest book, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest. The family that he focused on is the Bascom family up in New Hampshire. Douglas Wynot joining us today from Boston. Doug, you still teach at Emerson College, right?
Yes, I do. Yeah. I teach in the creative writing program.
Excellent. There. Can we talk about the flavor of maple syrup for a moment here? And because it gets me to my question about what happened in the 1960s. And I was curious about this. You heard me mention before that a lot of people know, or they think they know, maple syrup from Aunt Jemima, Mrs. Butterworth, store brand that's really, mostly corn syrup, right? So
yes.
I wondered, when it came to the maple syrup industry of, say, the 1950s and 60s, when these other products were coming onto the market, when King Corn was greatly influencing the market, it must have either put some maple syrup harvesters out of business or really, crunch their profits?
Well, when I was a kid, Vermont Made and Log Cabin had 2% maple syrup in their product. And I was told that that was a significant amount of syrup for producers, maple syrup producers. At one time, they had 15% in their product, and then they went down to 8, and then they went down to 2. And then one of the companies went to all artificial and gained market share. And so the other companies had to join in, and they all went to totally artificial with no maple syrup. And you'll notice that they don't, even though it looks like they might be maple, they don't use the word maple.
Oh, no.
Table syrups come as close as they can to associating with maple and the maple taste without actually... stating that they're maple.
Well, what's happened to the American taste for real maple syrup? I mean, it costs more. Obviously, it costs more to buy the real thing. To me, it's just not overly sweet. It's the real thing. That's what sells it for me. How do you feel about it?
Well, I feel it's a very special thing, too. I've thought about the maple taste, and there's no other original flavor that comes from North America, like maple. As a matter of fact, I can't think of any. I mean, you can think of chocolate, coffee, cinnamon, vanilla. They all come from tropical areas or international sources. But maple is an iconic flavor in New England. It has notes of vanilla and chocolate within it. And vanillin is a flavor precursor in maple, but it's got that special flavor. And the product itself is a quality product. It's an issue of quality. And I think I pay about $45 or $50 for a gallon of maple syrup, and I buy it at the sugar house. It's a wonderful experience. I know the people who produce it. It lasts a very long time if I use it correctly. And I think of it as quality. I think of quality as not a thing, but an event. And when you use real maple syrup on your table, it's a special event, whereas these others are just, it's a, just another dose of corn syrup and artificial flavor, in my mind. But a lot of people grew up with this. That's all they know. Maple syrup is expensive. It isn't everywhere. So there are a lot of people, especially in the South, who don't even know what the taste of maple syrup is like. And the effort in the United States now is to introduce more people to the flavor of maple or to maple syrup and convince them that it's worth buying.
So. Doug, thank you for that. A couple of quick questions by email from our listeners. Javier wants to know how old the trees are. How old are the trees in the syrup harvesting areas of New Hampshire?
Well, a maple tree can't be tapped until it's about 40 or 50 years old. But a maple tree can live to be 400 years old. And there are trees on Bascom's maple farms. And all throughout New Hampshire, it's one of the, and New England, it's one of the beautiful things about this region of the country where you have fields and roadsides that are lined with these ancient, gnarled, huge maple trees that are 200, 250 years old.
Another question from Kevin in Baltimore. How many gallons of sap does it take to make a gallon of pure maple syrup?
Well, the figure that they use usually is 40 gallons. If maple sap has 2% sugar, and that's about what it has, usually 2%. It can go down in 1% or up to 3 or 4%. But usually it's 2% sugar. And if it's 2%, then it takes 43 gallons of sap to make a gallon of maple syrup. But these days, there's a technology called reverse osmosis. It's like a desalinization machine that filters out the water. It actually filters the sugar molecules, and it is the maple sap is reduced down and concentrated so that it's possible to reduce it to 10 gallons of syrup of sap that you would need to make a gallon of syrup. Or if you have more reverse osmosis membranes and filters, you can take it down to 4 gallons so that it's 20% sugar before you boil it. And the commercial operations do that. It's much more cost effective and economical to boil. You know, boiling costs money. We use fuel to boil sap that's at 20% sugar rather than 2%.
Doug, I just want to take a minute to introduce someone else onto the show today. Jessica Janetta joining us for a few minutes here on Midday. She's a naturalist at the Oregon Ridge Nature Center. That's just north of Baltimore. And she's been doing maple sugar harvesting demonstrations out there. Jessica, nice to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
How was it this year? You just finished in February doing some maple sugar harvesting up there in Oregon Ridge. How'd it go this year?
Well, the weather hasn't been on our side. We do just demonstrations for education purposes. We do run school field trips throughout March, where we had our big maple sugar festivals 2 weekends ago. Last weekend, we had our pancake breakfast where we serve
the real thing.
The real thing. We don't make enough to supplement that. We actually have it shipped in, but it's kind of wraps up our big maple sugaring. So we actually kind of just roll with it from late January into mid-March, and that's kind of our season.
Now, if things go the way you want them to, you have like a January thaw during the day, a freeze at night. Is that the same routine?
Yeah.
But it's just that some years are better than others for that.
Right. So when we started tapping, we had a couple days where it was like the perfect conditions, and the trees were actually flowing, and then it got so cold again, and then they stopped flowing. And then when we were tapping some at our big festival day with the public, they were flowing a lot, and then it got cold again. So we haven't gotten too much sap, unfortunately.
Does the sap just come from maple trees?
No, we actually tap. So sugar maples, we're in the very southern end of the range. You don't really find them here unless they're planted. They can survive, but we normally do red maples and ash leaf maples, or they're also called box elders. But we also do a lot of black walnuts.
Black walnut produces some sap that can be made into syrup as well, huh?
Yep.
What's the flavor of that like? Is it any different? Can you tell?
It is. It comes out to be a lot darker than you would see the traditional maple syrup. And I've been told it has like more of a of richer flavor.
Hmm. And by the way, one last thing, Jessica, is there other harvesting of maples done around the Baltimore area? I mean, outside the Nature Center. I mean, is it done for real? Do people harvest, say, in Carroll County, Harford County? I don't know.
Not that I know for more than just educational purposes. Most of the nature and environmental centers throughout the area do
for demonstrations.
For demonstration purposes.
Right. But if you want to see the real thing, you got to go visit Leo Schinholt.
Yeah, you want to go a little
on the other side
west.
Of the creek in Corriganville in western Maryland, which most of my listeners here have never even heard of today. But I think we got to make a trip out there.
Definitely. Yeah. Check that guy out.
Well, Jessica, and Jessica, what did you think of the book? By the way, Douglas, we gave Jessica a copy of The Sugar Seed. Season.
Yeah, I finished it yesterday on my snow day. It was very interesting and intriguing, and I think a lot of people, you know, don't realize all the ins and outs of the maple syrup farming.
And, I think it's a little underappreciated because I guess what we were just talking about, it does cost more than the other stuff, and you can't, because it costs more, you're not going to pour a whole bunch of it onto a pancake. So you're going to just pour, lightly, but I've always found a little bit goes a long way. With the real thing, and it's worth a few extra bucks. And I like to keep a flask of it handy in my hip pocket and pull it out and take a sip. Oh no, on a cigar. I've been known to take a sip. I've been known to take a sip.
Oh, you're the maple syrup producer's dream.
I'm sorry. Listen, I grew up in New England too, and one of my favorite ice creams. Actually, I think it's my favorite ice cream is maple walnut ice cream.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Me too. I love it.
At Peaceful Meadow Farms in Whitman, Massachusetts, right outside in East Bridgewater, Massachusetts, Whitman. You know the place?
Oh, yeah.
Doug?
I know the area.
Okay.
I don't know the place.
I suggest go down Route 18.
Okay.
Route 18, Whitman near East Bridgewater, Peaceful Meadow Farms, and have their maple walnut ice cream. And I'd be surprised if they don't make it with the real thing.
Gee.
Well, thank you. And last thing I want to note is today is Fat Tuesday. Tomorrow being Ash, it's Pancake Day, so there's probably a lot of maple syrup being smeared out there, a lot of non-maple syrup too. But if you have a chance to try the real thing, try the real thing. If you're interested in how one farmer does this, one family produces it and survives, and the ins and outs of this industry, is a very well-written book, The Sugar Season: A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest, by our guest this hour of the show, Douglas Wynot, who teaches at Emerson at College in Boston. So, Doug, nice to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Yep. It was a real pleasure.
Yeah, it was terrific. Thank you very much for the hour.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, and Jessica, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And, folks, if you're interested in the demonstrations out at the Oregon Ridge Nature Center, pay attention. Usually January and February is when you get a chance to see them out there. All right. Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's our midday for today. I want to mention that lunch is provided for us on Wednesdays by Breathe Bookstore Cafe, serving inspired vegetarian, vegan, gluten-free savories and sweets and more, open 7 days a week at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Get more information at breathebooks.com. We thank Breathe Bookstore Cafe for providing lunch for our guests on Wednesday. I hope you have a great afternoon. Thank you for tuning into our show. We'll see you again soon.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Hemowitz. Our interns are Luke Spicknell, James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.